is a project which attempts to think through the kind of sub-media, or the things that exist below the surface of what manifests as media. So kind of algorithmic forces, logical structures, data structures, but also things that appear at biological levels as media, chemical signaling systems, and so on. So to try and think through a theory of media that is below the level of representation. It's not to say that we're excluding ideas of representation or identity or indexicality that classical media studies works with, but what we wanted to do was to try and think through the conditions of media in the present. As media is increasingly digitized and computational and networked, new kinds of analysis, new kinds of understanding pertain. In the context of new media theory, we wanted to make a space for something that was relatively dark. So the book we model there's a series of books, a cluster of books of evil texts that we take as our model. Things like Schopenhauer's How to Win Arguments, a series of stratagems, rhetorical stratagems for defeating your opponent, no matter what the argument is about, no matter whether you're right or wrong. And we're also interested in kind of resurrecting the techniques of sophistry as a technique itself. So we're interested in relationship to the question of technicity and persuasion, and technicity and the kind of ordering of subjectivity. Perhaps the key text which defines our work is Machiavelli's The Prince. And we think that, you know, because there are so many similarities between 15th century Florence and 21st century Brussels, we're very glad to be able to present this work here. The point of view the book takes is that of a perplexed power, a power that tries to think through stratagems based on extreme formalizations of human behavior, of understanding, of control, but which nevertheless finds its stratagems, its formalizations, constantly misunderstood or setting up moires between themselves which allow different kinds of escape, different kinds of possibilities to occur. So although 21st century power exists in the mode of humanitarianism, it exists in the mode of transparency and in the mode of humanitarianism that we've heard much about in terms of the values of free software. We want to think how power manifests in this age. While it is ostensibly moral, while it's ostensibly ethical, what would be the case if we were to set up a reading of contemporary media systems in which evil was the primary purpose? This is not to say necessarily that we necessarily endorse such a position, but we think that occupying this particular space of thought is a useful experiment to think through some of the consequences of contemporary changes in media. So what we're going to do is read through a number of stratagems and give you a kind of idea of how this approach relates to the question of grey literature and grey media. Okay.
Thanks, Matt. Okay, I'm going to talk through two stratagems. The first really tries to deal with this issue of grey media, grey literature. In a way, it's about trying to think through what a form of grey criticism might be to go with grey literature and grey media. And it's also about trying to explore the possible legacy systems that we might use to help us explore the ways in which media can be used to manipulate and control. When I've done that, I'm going to talk a little bit about something which I think probably ties in very closely to the previous presentation. I'm going to talk about user error as something that can be exploited within the workplace in particular as part of a dynamic of the exercise of power and the maintaining of relations of control. Okay, so would you like me to put this thing on?
I can give you the hand mics, but then you have to really hold them.
Can I just say this? No?
Yeah, the thing is, it's meant to talk into like that.
Okay.
And because you talk into like that, it's okay, like so exploding.
Like this. I don't want to make you deaf at the back there. Sorry.
It's the P's and the B's, they all go.
Okay, so no P's.
And T's and
No P's and no B's.
Or lower than. Just delete them.
Okay, so there'll be no P's or B's in this presentation, which is unfortunate because the first stratagem is called systemic ambiguity. Okay, sorry about this. Okay, in a world in which the primary economic horizon is one of war in its various modalities, including conflict with the irreducible other, the perpetual struggle of all against all, or asymmetric warfare, the kind of practical criticism traditionally carried out by intelligence and counterintelligence operatives becomes a vital necessity. That's better. Okay, so the kind of criticism traditionally carried out by intelligence and counterintelligence operatives becomes a vital necessity. The surprise conjunction of literary criticism and geopolitical strategizing represented by the Cold War intelligence practices at senior levels of the CIA and its forerunners allowed for an attentiveness to and cultivation of ambiguity that presented an invaluable means for monitoring, evaluating, manipulating, and deceiving the other. Ambiguity and the mental conflict it discloses, or indeed creates, is at once a diagnostic tool to the extent that it symptomatizes potentially antagonistic or threatening intentions, and a critical weapon to the extent that it creates doubts, uncertainties, and the possibilities for divergences in the field of action in which it's at work. The historical connections between James Angleton, infamous head of counterintelligence in the CIA after the Second World War, certain currents in American modernist writing, and the new critical approach to the study of literary texts, exemplified by the work of William Empson, offers some intriguing possibilities that it's difficult not to tune into. Indeed, for the intelligence operative based in an office in Langley in Virginia, in Ludovisi in Rome, or in St. James's in London, applying the same scrupulous attention to textual detail and the nuances of phrase in a covert operation such as HT Lingual, which was a CIA operation where they kind of went through, systematically opened all communications between America and the Soviet Union. Applying the same scrupulous attention to textual detail in such an operation as would once have been applied to a reading of a poem by Ezra Pound or a letter composed to E.E. Cummings appears not only as a geopolitical imperative and defense of imperiled values, but also as a harbinger of things to come. Technically, the movement of Angleton's practical criticism is from the document to the text, and from the text through close reading to the other and their intentions. The necessity of such a movement is predicated on William Empson's view, which is itself stated with ambiguity, that, and I quote, "The fundamental situation, whether it deserves to be called ambiguous or not, is that a word or a grammatical structure is effective in several ways at once. For Empson, almost anything could be considered ambiguous. Hence, the rationale for new criticism and the strategy of close reading that it defended, but hence also the specific practices of James Angleton through the Second World War and into the Cold War period and his consolidation of power in the newly minted position of the CIA's head of counterintelligence. For the grey eminence determined to exercise the strategic calculus of statecraft, it takes but a small permutation of the terms involved in Empson's claim that the machinations of ambiguity among the very roots of poetry to find an artful beauty in deception. However, for literary critics and intelligence operatives working in the era of mass media, with the still unchallenged cultural hegemony of the book and an education in literature as yet untroubled by the tensions to which the presence of minorities would expose the literary canon, the kind of ambiguity to which their eyes and ears were sensitive could be seen to arise from the intentionality and mental conflict of individuals immersed in a single language, and what is more, a language that can be considered the bearer of largely consensual but somewhat threatened cultural values. So whilst for Empson the concern was one of bringing language under control, exploring and exploiting the covert action of ambiguity or practicing new criticism CIA style was dependent on the idea that the cracks and faults in the use of language symptomatize an intention that is often undisclosed, thereby betraying a form of mental conflict which had to be disclosed for matters of national security. Little matter really that the intention could be a fantasized one of some threat to world historical destiny. Ambiguity is an indicator of deception and thus indicative of a forthcoming action that must be thwarted, turned or inhibited, influenced by the production of material that guides. The conviction of Angleton's practical criticism is that the other is always the bearer of a hidden message that close reading can disclose. And if it can't, if ambiguity cannot be resolved, then there are other techniques available for the disclosure or production of hidden truths. And naturally, of course, if the other isn't behaving deceptively before the adoption of countermeasures, you can be sure that they will afterwards, as the myriad forms of blowback in response to the CIA attest. But the world we live in today is a world of scripts, of databases, of data structures and algorithms, a world of data and machines as much as of texts or documents. Equivocal language includes not only the semantic richness of Shakespearean diction and the stutter phonics of Gertrude Stein, but also the arid dryness and obsessively repetitive ordering of assembly language and the fanatical deductive hierarchies of first-order predicate calculus. Likewise, the intentional action of an individual is only a limit case of a more general and more dispersed array of forms of agency working with us, against us, with each other, against each other, humans talking to machines, machines talking to humans, machines talking to machines, and so on. In such circumstances, ambiguity is more helpfully understood as something that arises not from conflicted or covertly oppositional intentions. Yes. Yeah. Okay, I'll go much slower. Yeah, sure. Okay, I know. It's not normal, no. Yes. Okay, I could try and read it in French maybe, but that might make things even worse. We've got copies of the text which we'll happily for the audience. Okay. Okay, so what I was saying was that we have to move away from an idea of literary criticism as something that revolves around texts, and if you want to understand grey criticism, we have to think of ambiguity as something that is systemic, that results from the relationships between different kinds of media system, okay, and between humans and media systems. So I'm suggesting that ambiguity is more helpfully understood as something that arises from the relationship between media systems, in which zones of indeterminacy arise because no system ever exists in isolation and no system is ever truly closed. Now, under such circumstances, the appeal to formal language can only offer a temporary solution. And I'm thinking the kind of immense process of the logicization of language that was undertaken by analytic philosophers in the 20th century is very much an attempt to kind of control language and to try and find a way of dealing with the ambiguities that it produces. So the logician Alfred Tarski, in one of his pieces of writing, talks about what he calls the evil that natural languages contain. And of course, formal languages, for Tarski, the advantage of formal languages is that they don't contain this kind of evil. But the problem, of course, is that formal languages themselves don't exist in isolation. And even the most fanatical analytic philosopher inevitably has to use natural language as a way to try and exemplify the logical structures that he or she wants to analyze. So, placed in the context of their use, all languages and the discourses or programs that they produce exhibit a sort of untranslatable remainder whose effects can go unfelt or unnoticed until they're subject to the merciless exploitation of a hacker or the accumulated blows of a critic. So when systems interact, the patterns of behavior that they exhibit, their potential for mutual misinterpretation grows from something that arises between them, a crack, a fault, or a translation failure, which then becomes a critical factor composing their internal states and evolutionary dynamic. And we're using some of Gilles Deleuze's ideas. He talks about the notion of an ambiguous sign to try and kind of explain what we mean by this idea of systemic ambiguity. Far from reducing the opportunities for manipulation and deception, this new situation of systemic ambiguity opens up and extends the scope of counterintelligence operations for the astute media operative. Under such circumstances, though, maintaining the prerogatives of a dominant imperial culture, which is part of what we take the operation of Angleton to have been about, becomes a challenge. So from the point of view of power, we can perhaps be thankful that there are many tools and techniques available to us for detecting and tracking the kinds of ambiguities that arise systemically. Such ambiguities can be dealt with using algorithms and data structures in data valence or forensic computing technologies. However, in a period in which it's difficult to trace patterns of conflict and the emergence of antagonism back to a single binary opposition, such as that existed in the Cold War, the grey zones of grey media call for new forms of investigation and a more nuanced approach to the kinds of tensions and patterns of interference that arise between them. So if the operatives of the Cold War could reserve for themselves the position of l'éminence grise, or the distant advisor to the executive power, the new spaces of collectively intelligent networks and the relationships that these put into place demand the position of l'immanence grise, Okay, crucially for us, systemic ambiguity is as much about the production as it is about the deciphering of signs. Being able to read the shifting balance and distribution of forces in fluctuating patterns of signs is one thing. So whether we're talking about the crude color-coded aesthetics of a user interface or the body language of a bank of a client in a bank, their body language doesn't mesh with the kind of linear unfolding of the questionnaire that the bank cashier is using to ask them questions with. Let me just go back. So it's one thing being able to read these signs. So, and we, you know, these kinds of ambiguities are generated everywhere. In different kinds of interface, in the interaction between particular kinds of computer technology and their users, and so on and so forth. There's a more difficult task though, which is how you produce such ambiguity, and we take it that this is part of the operation of power, is to try to generate uncertainty, generate ambiguity, to leave open spaces for indeterminacy. There are a number of ways in which this can be done. You can reskill or modernize a workforce. This is one way of doing it. So you can get rid of expensive technophobic old timers, and thus introducing a new form of media technology. Or you can play off the generations in the workplace, a more flexible younger generation who are happier adapting to new technology and have anxieties about the cultural privileges accruing to older forms of media technology, for example. But what is difficult under such circumstances is to maintain and affirm ambiguity as such. And this, I think, what we're trying to suggest here is that although ambiguity can be exploited in the workplace, and outside of the workplace as a means of exercising control, there's a certain limit to this, because the kind of ambiguity that we're interested in really is the kind of ambiguity that is associated with what somebody like Foucault would see as the reversibility and instability of power relations as such. Uncertainty communicates with a perception of a lack of power and an inability to act decisively. So to prolong indeterminacy, to prolong ambiguity, means almost by definition to increase the likelihood of contestation. When one media system doesn't succeed in subordinating another, the translation failures that symptomatize the fault between them points to something that has gone wrong, an aberration in a mediation process. The crucial point about what we're calling systemic ambiguity, though, is that it's as dispersed as the forms of mediation that make up agency as such. We think this is crucial to the development of an adequate strategic calculus. And so really what we're suggesting is that ambiguity in the Angleton world, the world of William Empson and James Angleton, quickly becomes an ambiguity that it is laid at the door, if you like, of the individual. It's made the individual's responsibility. You don't express yourself clearly enough. And we're suggesting that this is a little bit too easy a way to deal with ambiguity, because it misses out the kind of collective forms of action that take place in a new media world. So when the ambiguities of the other are added to the balance sheet of morality, it's the behaviour of the network as such that is missed. Okay, that was a kind of an improvised version of what we're trying to say about systemic ambiguity. I appreciate that it was that the English was quite involved. What I want to talk about now, and I think this will make clearer some of what I was saying, I want to talk a little bit about user error. Now, as somebody who programs or tries to program computers, user error is something that I'm very familiar with. I'm not a very good programmer. And how one handles error in computer code is really quite crucial to the art of producing good, unambiguous software. What I want to talk about a little bit here, though, is the way in which user error can function in shaping shaping relations in the world of work. So user error is something that is traditionally overlooked for its value in shaping relations in the world of work. The imputation of user error, with its associated prejudices and insults, is typically thought of as a psychological problem bearing on the competence or otherwise of the workforce. The rollout of a new information system to record expenses, to process insurance claims, to book train tickets, the list is endless, throws up its own quite specific ambiguities when brought into relations with other kinds of system, human or machine. User error is often the result of poor design decisions, bad interfaces, the lack of flexibility programmed into an application for the accomplishment of a task, the non-existence of flexible workarounds or life hacks. But it's also frequently the simple result of users failing to think like machines, of persisting to think in terms of the categories of natural language, rather than embracing the redesign of work in the orderly terms of algorithms and data structures. In this sense, user error can be thought of as a product of systemic ambiguity. And because of the way that it often operates at the most banal level of human-machine interaction, it's actually an excellent means of generating fog around the introduction of sophisticated forms of media. In some respects, user error, like the bugs that our immersion in natural languages produce, testifies to the evil that Alfred Tarski was concerned to fight against. The explicitness of the rules according to which formal systems or digital media using formal computational methods demonstrate operates as a way of passing judgment on the transparency of the actions and statements of those people who use those systems. User error arises at the interface between different kinds of system, between a computer user and their software application in particular. And because of this, user error can act to disclose some of the mutations and conflicts that arise in a changing environment of work and the changing configurations of relationship to which this gives rise. So the idea here is rather than to think about user error simply as a sort of technical problem that goes away when you redesign an application in a less ambiguous manner, actually user error is symptomatic of a broader set of social relationships that, you know, are taking place in a workplace or outside of the workplace. So, I mean, I think, you know, the script that somebody follows in a call centre, for example, I'm just trying to explain what I mean about how kind of errors testify to broader changes. So, you know, I mean, I've never worked in a call centre, but, you know, I find it difficult reading from pieces of paper here. I find it next to impossible to understand how somebody who works in a call centre can produce a convincing kind of conversational tone when they're reading from a, you know, they've got a series of minute algorithmic steps to follow when they're interacting with somebody. So I think it kind of exemplifies this kind of ambiguity that can be generated when two different systems come into interaction with each other. So the script that's followed in a call centre confers a kind of meter on the movements of persuasion and influence in a conversation and adds an external measure on the simple joy of speaking, which then works its way into the way in which we parse and understand language. The caller, interacting with a speaker in a call centre, adjusts themselves accordingly, and the pragmatics of the speech situation that they're engaged in twist and change subtly. So when somebody in a call centre says, "Have a nice day," they don't mean that. What they mean is that the supervisor can stop listening into the work that they're doing. So under these circumstances, actions which might once have been performed as if they were second nature, judgments that may once have been formulated as a routine element of local knowledge, become accomplished in a halting, uncertain way. And we think that these kinds of halting, hesitant, uncertain, ambiguous situations tend to be created wherever one system decodes and recodes another and generates patterns of behaviour that are in conflict with the expectations that the new system puts into play. User error tends to increase to the extent that divergences from the norm increase. Conflicted mentality, which is easy to blame on stupidity and a failure to internalize new norms of production. So, you know, we heard before, you know, read the fucking manual is a refrain that's heard fairly constantly, you know, on mailing lists. But also, if you've ever worked on a computer help desk, or you watch people working on a computer help desk talking to users on the phone, you know, they often will put the phone down and talk about how absolutely unbelievably stupid they think the user that they've just been talking to is. So it's very easy to blame user error on the stupidity of the end user. We think that it's more a sign of the kind of bifurcations that are brought into play in a shifting ecology of media forms. And beyond a certain threshold, persistent user error can be cast as deviance, motivational deficit, a lack of adhesion to the beliefs expressed in a company's mission statement, a failure to meet the requirements specified in the job description, a failure in the educational system, a weakness in the labour market. People like to say you can't get the staff these days. Technically, user error communicates with the broader problem of the exceptions that are generated when one fails to anticipate the kinds of interactions that can take place between systems or between elements in a system. So I'm thinking about object-oriented programming here, and the methods that you write for a piece of object-oriented software, you know, typically in good code, are designed to throw an exception if some kind of error occurs. So, you know, just if you're writing a piece of software that's got to parse and decode natural language, if this is maybe on some sort of website to kind of take a name and split it up into its component parts, you know, a bad programmer will find it very difficult to write something that can correctly decode somebody like C. Wright Mills. So if your name, as is often the case in America, begins with an initial letter and then you have your name, it's very difficult for a bad programmer to encompass the kind of exceptions that throws. So there's a link between the generation of user error and the kind of anticipations that software programmers have to be able to make when they design a system. Obviously, the building blocks for many applications these days, class libraries that are supplied as standard with a programming language or are developed by software companies for sale or are available in open source, test out the bulk of problems that can arise. And this reduces the frequency with which software hangs. But programming languages do considerably more work for the programmer now than in the past. And it's not unreasonable to suggest that if user error declines to some extent, this is partly because users have become more used to the syntax of software systems. Okay. The way user error is used, I'm thinking about some of my experiences working on big software development projects in the United Kingdom, and how software companies, when they're challenged about the software that they produced, how they will handle these problems. And the idea that the user is stupid is one that recurs quite frequently. But it's a strategy that can only last for so long. Of course, blaming systemic ambiguity and user error on the stupidity of the user does fit in rather nicely with the individualization and responsibilization of the workforce today. However, as a strategy, it's a double-edged sword. Because to be in charge of and take responsibility for a system, and therefore accepting the praise when it works properly, also means accepting a level of responsibility for its failure. If you continue to maintain that your staff really are that stupid, the suspicion will arise that you're a cretin too. Okay. There is some more. I mean, there are some other things that I wanted to say, but I think I'll probably let Matt develop his stuff. Where I was going to go with this is this idea that in some ways, the existence of user error is a good thing, because for as long as people don't fully understand how to use a piece of software, it suggests that they haven't fully internalized the expectations that the piece of software requires or requires of them in order to function correctly. So when people start to think very much like machines and don't challenge them in quite the ways that one might have hoped, this is where you get the biggest kind of dangers arise. And I was going to go back and talk a little bit about sort of intelligence gathering practices. And there's a little anecdote. Kim Philby, who was a spy for the KGB in Great Britain, was considered to be, by many people that worked in MI5 and MI6 and in the CIA, as the perfect spy. He never ever put a foot wrong. You know, he had internalized the norms of the operations in which he was involved to a T. And therefore, he never raised any suspicion whatsoever. So the point I want to make there, and of course, he then, you know, he was all the time that he was operating in this kind of perfectly professional manner. He was passing information back to the KGB. Nobody suspected him. So the point I'm trying to make there is that, you know, in a world where we adapt ourselves to the perfections of code, where people will talk about the seamlessness of flowing work or frictionless capitalism, as Bill Gates did, our tireless dedication to the commands of the machine is where the greatest danger for us lies. Because in the absence of uncertainty, in the absence of user error, we find a signal that the compliant user is being used, and, as they like to say, code has become law. Okay, so I'll let Matt do the next thing.
Okay. Okay, you're more? Okay. Well, thanks for your patience. Yeah, so what we're trying to do is write in this strategematic way, which proposes a kind of pragmatics, ways of operating within these media systems. We're not trying to set up a complete set of beliefs or a complete kind of manual for operations. What we want to do is just set up some kind of cuts into or some ways of suggested ways of working with these systems. And when we talk about grey immanence, one of this kind of ways of thinking imminently with digital media, with computational media systems, means to understand also some of the kind of aesthetic questions that are implied. So one of those is recursion. Recursion is a special cultural pleasure of programmers. The use of a procedure which involves a series of discrete steps, one of which is the relaunch of the procedure. I'll say it again. Actually, I won't. This relaunching, which aids both concision and economy, doesn't have to be simply stacked one inside the other. Recursion may involve the launch of another procedure, which in turn launches the first one, or such as in a piece of software working its way through websites by following one link, then another, at each point splitting into a copy of itself to carry out the same behavior, to self-delete once an endpoint in the chain of links has been reached. Typically, recursion will be handled by a loop, a sequence of instructions in which a program performs a set of operations, looping back to repeat them again until a specific condition is satisfied. But recursion may also be something far more systematic and pleasing. First of all, recursion is not a reinstantiation of the same. It may consist of a derivable pattern of activity, of self-similarity, but in a condition in which each recursive event is different in terms of its scale, location in time, in the complications it may entail, and in terms of its place in relation to its nesting within other recursions or to those in which it is in turn nested. As such, recursion may be used to organize heterogeneous material into a singular pattern. One of these singular patterns may be the question of control or political ordering. Control requires recursion. And this is its innovative answer to the